You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 106 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. Hello.
Hello, and we should get to this week's beer quickly because a toast is in order.
A toast.
And I'm making you talk about extensively.
I mean, I'm not unhappy to talk about it. I just didn't know we were trying to explain.
What do we have here today?
We have here the Golden Road Brewing from LA, Mango Cart Mango Wheat Ale. Which I chose largely because look at how great this packaging is. There's a lovely...
You don't see the 24-ounce can of nicer beers too often.
I think this is becoming a thing.
Oh, really?
Because there was also the other option I was considering was a couple of 10-barrel beers that were in the same format.
24-ounce cans?
Yeah.
Really?
I think it's becoming a thing.
I'm okay with that being a thing.
Anyway, it's some lovely packaging here. Got all sorts of nice colors and a man with a mustache selling mangoes out of his cart.
He looks kind of like Tom Selleck.
I can definitely see that. I feel like Chris Smith, Third Pelton brother Chris Smith, would tweet a photo of this can for the mustache and relate it to the Mariners somehow. Anyway, they say it is a series inspired by the fruit carts, iconic fruit cart vendors of Los Angeles.
Oh, Los Angeles, known for its hops. I guess I'm going to have to pour this for you because I poured rosé into my cup.
Yeah.
You have water in your second cup. I have rosé in my second cup.
That really says a lot about the differences between the two members of the Pelton cast.
Well, there you are. I'm going to go get another cup.
Okay.
I'm not sure how I feel about the 24-ounce can, actually, now that I think about it. Because I feel like there's a tendency to get pretty warm once you get to the bottom of the 24-ounce can.
That's fair.
Now, in the past, I've argued that if that's the case, you know what that means.
That you need to drink it faster?
You should be drinking faster.
Yeah, that's fair.
Is that fair? Agree with that?
I mean, if there's two of us drinking it, it should be the same as a 12-ounce can, right?
Ooh.
That's good. Use the guy thinking gif.
So what are we toasting to here?
We are toasting to the return of...
The triumphant return.
The return of the Mac?
No.
Well, sort of. The return of...
The triumphant return.
The triumphant return of the premier radio station of our childhood and of our entire lives, probably. Cube 93 FM is back!
It is back, baby! Eric Powers is back.
Nope.
The Heavy
nope.
7 at 7 is
nope.
back. The old school lunch is back. Shelly Goddamn Hart is back.
Nope, none of those things are back. But... Cube 93 is back.
So none of those things. DJ Super Sam is back.
Nope,
the T-Man.
A bunch of people you have never heard of, many of whom are not actually broadcasting from Seattle, are just being, what's the word I'm looking for
syndicated.
Here? Syndicated from other radio stations. Thank you. That's back. But the name Cube 93 is back. That's the important thing here.
So this is huge news. We didn't get to talk about... We were not podcasting when Cube 93 went away, right?
That's accurate.
Wow! We didn't get to get our thoughts off. We didn't get to memorialize Cube 93. But what we can do...
Wow, that is very mango-y.
Oh, that's good. I'm excited about
that. It is. It's delicious.
Is we can reminisce about Cube 93 now that it is back because it was dark times. They had the ads, the billboards, right, when it turned to Power 93. And it featured, if I do recall correctly, like Taylor Swift, Justin Bieber, and there might have been like Toby Keith in there.
Toby Keith was definitely not in there.
Maybe Katy Perry. How about that?
That seems reasonable.
Maybe there was some One Direction going on.
I don't think so, but it's plausible.
And it was very natural to see those signs and think to yourself, white Power 93. It would have been impossible not to have thought that.
So this happened in January 2016, a big shakeup of the iHeart radio stations in Seattle as part of the Clear Channel conglomerate. Cube had been, with a brief interruption, playing rhythmic contemporary since 1991.
What was the brief interruption?
Apparently there's a period where...
December 31st, 1998, when they played only the song 1999 by Prince that entire day. That was the brief interruption. Maybe it was January 1st, 1999.
Well, there was also every year at Christmas, they used to play Christmas songs just like Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, if I recall correctly.
Good times.
What a time. That like set my template for what I want Christmas music to be. That and Sufjan Stevens.
I
want to
hear Santa Baby over and over and over again.
Exactly. Anyways, no, there was a brief period of time where apparently they were playing some grunge alongside that.
What?
Look, the 90s were a wild, crazy time. I can't defend them.
They played like hip hop hits and grunge at the same time. That's what Wikipedia says. The kids want.
I don't remember this. We would have been listening to Cube, I'm sure, at this time.
I don't think that happened.
I can't say I remember.
Like, I'm skeptical of this.
I mean, the Wikipedia could be making it up.
I question Wikipedia.
Anyways, but that all changed in January 2016. Cube went to a Tacoma based signal on 104.9 FM,
which I personally only know as Funky Monkey.
Through last December, when it got sold as part of a Complex radio station deal and then became Christian music.
I've tuned in thinking that I was getting to the other Cube.
Always very confusing. Yeah. So in the city of Seattle, we've had 103.7, where Eric Powers went after Cube changed formats.
Is he still there?
As far as I know, yes.
Oh, well, good for him.
And they're playing throwback hip hop.
Oh.
Which is great. It's like old school lunch all day long.
103.7?
Yeah, Sir Mix-a-Lot.
The Mountain is playing.
They haven't been the Mountain for a long time. Sir Mix-a-Lot is also on there.
Okay, so that is kind of like Q93 in the 90s.
Yes, but they're strictly playing throwback, which is great. Don't get me wrong. I have long argued that there should be radio stations that are simply 90s hip hop, and that because all anyone wants is nostalgia. But there was no place to find strictly hip hop contemporary on the radio in Seattle.
It's insane, right? Considering that this is the predominant genre, right?
It is. Yeah.
I mean, every morning I wake up and on my drive to work, I think to myself, should I listen to NPR's Up First podcast or should I listen to Migos? But since this is the predominant genre in all of music, there was no station in Seattle playing. It's a shocking thing, right? I mean, it was a long overdue change in format.
And what I predicted, you'll recall at the time, we were obviously very unhappy about this change. And everyone was unhappy about it because people hate change more than anything. That was my specific take, is that people hate the concept of change more than they'd like any specific change you could make.
I'm still upset about this Mountain thing. I mean, I like the old school hip hop, but where am I going to listen to my Dave Matthews Band?
All very fair. So I predicted that they were eventually going to go back. And then I thought I was wrong because it took a long period of time and Cube went off the air entirely for 5 months. And I was like, yeah, you know, you win some, you lose some. We're going to chalk this down with my 2018 Boston Celtics predictions.
Oh, no.
Put those in the same category.
When your predictions are bold enough, you want them to be wrong sometimes. What? To know that you have making bold enough predictions.
That was Third Pelton brother Mina Kimes' take on our bold prediction show going into 2018. But it turned out, given a long enough timeline, I was right.
That's all you need to do is wait. Every bold prediction eventually comes true. The Seahawks are going to win the 2014 Super Bowl.
They're against the Steelers.
Given enough time. 13, 14, and 15 against the Steelers.
Outstanding. Should we talk a little bit about what Cube means to us?
Oh, my God. I mean, Cube, let's say that Cube set the framework for our entire lives. It was not only the soundtrack.
Our entire lives? Wow.
I mean, look.
I learned statistical analysis from Cube.
That you were probably listening to Cube when you first learned of statistical analysis.
I mean, I don't know when I first learned of it.
You were probably actually listening to the Road Trip soundtrack.
So you posted on Instagram a list of your searches this evening, explaining that we were going to be talking about Cube. Quad City DJs, My Boo, and Da Dip. Mm-hmm. And I know specifically that Quad City DJs, The Train, and Da Dip were on the radio station concurrently, and specifically at a time where I can recall, like, playing Tony La Russa baseball.
Tony La Russa baseball?
Yeah, that was a very formative statistical thing for me.
So you did learn stats from Q93, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
By the way,
the Quad City DJs played at an NBA game over the weekend.
Oh, wow. Good for them.
The Sixers game?
Still playing shows. But what Q93 means is California Love, Return to the Mac, right? The Dip, Summer 1995. No greater summer ever.
That sounds about right. That checks out.
Best summer of our youth, summer 1995. That's what Q93 means. It means listening to these same six songs over and over and over again in our mom's Dodge Dynasty, driving to Wild Waves.
That all sounds about right.
Going on the train ride and singing The Train by Quad City DJs.
Yep.
And occasional trying to high-five people.
Yep, on the Scrambler.
So, I went ahead and Mrs. Fantasy Genius, she was so excited about Q93 coming back that she went ahead and complicatedly dictated her top five Q93 songs ever.
Outstanding. I love it.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. Okay, you ready for this?
I don't know.
What are some songs that you associate with Q93? To me, California Love, Mo Money, Mo Problems, definitely Return of the Mac.
I mean, those are all good songs. I,
there's nothing else that you associate?
I don't know. That's a hard question for me to answer.
The other thing is I remember Old School Lunch listening to, because they didn't just play hip hop on the Old School Lunch, right? The Rappin' Duke, which was hip hop. But I remember for the first time hearing like When Doves Cry by Prince on the Old School Lunch.
Yeah, that checks out.
And stuff like that. It's like they were playing real classic music and also the Rappin' Duke. I mean, we understood a Biggie reference just because of the Old School Lunch.
Yes.
Okay, coming in at number five on Mrs. Fantasy Genius's top five Q93 songs ever.
Okay. Can you read it?
Too Close by Next.
Oh, yeah. That, I think, is in pretty frequent rotation on 103.7.
Is it? I'm sure that these are all in pretty frequent rotation.
I would imagine. It would be weird if they weren't.
I think that Mrs. Fantasy Genius probably skews a little bit more R&B than we would have.
That's probably true.
Part of one of the experiences of listening to Q93 was just kind of sitting through the R&B songs. You got to get through the Jodeci to get to the Biggie.
I don't know if I necessarily had that negative of an experience with the Jodeci.
Coming in at number four, All My Life by Casey and JoJo.
There you go. This is so far all sounding very much like a concert that surely gets played at occurs at the Shore Center.
Yes. Coming in at number three, Nice and Slow by Usher.
Wow. Okay.
I remember for the first time, oh God, what was that first? Was it My Way? That was the first Usher single that I think came out.
It sounds right.
I remember hearing that and being like, this guy. Somehow Usher has managed to, of almost all of the Q93 artists, to have had maybe some of the most staying power of any of those artists. By the way, I Can't Stand the Rain. You know how much they played that song?
Yeah, it was a lot.
The other people that have different classic Timbaland and Missy Elliott songs, but to me it's all about I Can't Stand the Rain, because we heard it like prisoners of Q93 like 4,000 times in a year.
I mean, I was going to point out, so I've listened to Cube a little bit since it came back, and it's like, oh man, this is everything I hated about Cube, but also love. Because sometimes when the song is first out, and especially in 1995, when you couldn't just go to Spotify and play it, you couldn't just go to YouTube and load up the music video anytime you want. And that song is hot and it's fresh and you want to hear it like once an hour, every single hour. And then it was great.
At number two, a song that I definitely forgotten about until this moment. Deja Vu, Uptown Baby by Lord Tariq and Peter Guns.
How dare you forget that song?
Oh my God. This was a life-changing song for us when this song came out.
Sounds about right. I feel like this is one of the songs that helped me understand the different boroughs of New York.
That's what Q93 was all about.
Along with Doing It by LL Cool J, which I think would also fall into this category.
He talks about the boroughs and...
She represents Bronx. I was raised out in Brooklyn.
Oh, I understand. And at number one, the song West Side by TQ.
Wait, what?
Oh, hold on. Hold on. You're going to recognize this. You could pause if you'd like, but we're listening to West Side by TQ right now.
All right, it took a while. It took till the hook, but then I recognized it.
Well, shouting out to the whole wide West Side. Okay, and she has an honorable mention.
Of course.
The song Body Bumpin' Yippee-Yi-Yo by Public Announcement. We might have to pause to listen to that also.
I got nothing here.
I'm just shocked that Wanna Be a Baller wasn't on there. I feel like maybe Mrs. Fantasy Genius didn't remember Wanna Be a Baller. But also, I was reminded when we were watching the West Side video, the song Crossroads by Bone Thugs and Harmony, which may be the song I've listened to the most in my entire life.
I mean, that's a bold statement.
I'm saying it's easily in the top 10. Think about it. Because songs that you listen to now, if there's a song that I like now, I might listen to it 20 times, right? We listened to the song 20 times in a single day in 1996.
I mean, that does check out. That does sound about right. I'm sure a lot of Skilo songs are in your top 10.
God, I really wish that somebody was keeping track of the songs that you've heard the most ever.
Man.
But the like they wore out the Crossroads on KXP. Oh,
Cube.
Or sorry, it's KXP. Did not know what that was.
No. We're not listening to all of that in 1995.
1995 was unfamiliar with KXP, KCMU, or anything that could remotely be considered college rock.
Yes. Yes.
It's amazing that Cube 93 is back. Look, I'm not going to listen to it, but I just want to know that it's there.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's like the Rainier R. It doesn't mean anything, but you want to see it. Right? It doesn't mean that they're brewing Rainier beer in there, but you know you're in Seattle when you see that Rainier R.
Yeah, that checks out.
Does that? Okay.
I buy that logic. Whew. Anything else on Cube?
Another toast to Cube.
Oh, yeah. Multiple toasts. By the way, we've got through the 25 ounces pretty quickly, haven't we?
Is it 25 ounces?
Yeah, it's 25, not 24. It's very smooth. Anyways, let's go from Cube
back to our search for Seattle's best tacos / burrito.
And only I will be delivering an interview this week, as you did not make it to our location this week. But that's okay. Is, of course, you are very familiar with Blue Water Taco Grill, a Seattle fixture. I was trying to look up exactly how long Blue Water Taco Grill has been open. I'm pretty sure Queen Anne was the first location, right?
It seems right.
That seems like it was. There was a review from 2005, so we know it goes back at least that far, and that's about how when I first remember going there when I was working for the Sonics down the hill from it. But it's been around a long time. There are now 7 locations in the Seattle area.
It's kind of shocking how many locations. It's like the place that you walk by, but it doesn't like click. It's almost like Great State is kind of turning into that.
It could be.
Where you're like, oh, there's Great State, but it's not like a destination. Like, if you asked me where's Tacos Chuki's, I know where every single Tacos Chuki's is and where they are in relation to where I'm at currently. But
you know exactly how many miles you are away from a Tacos Chuki's at all times? You say that, but I also know that you have zero sense of direction. So it's not possible.
But you had to remind me earlier today that there was a Blue Water Taco Grill kind of near my work.
But you had said that last week to me when we talked about it on the podcast.
Completely gone from my brain.
There's one in the Armory, which is where I've gone most frequently lately.
That's by far the fanciest one. That's like Taco Series. That's like Blue Water Taco Cantina.
Yes. It's the fanciest one, but I don't think the quality is very good there.
I don't think the quality at any of them is very good.
Well, that's a potentially fair take. Anyway, so that's why. So normally, when I'm going to Blue Water at a Seattle Storm game or before a Seattle Storm game, as the case may be, I'll just walk right over to the Armory. But today, since we were reviewing, I wanted to go to the First Avenue location because of the fact that I consider it a higher quality Blue Water, and ordered up.
So they still have both locations.
Yes.
Okay.
Ordered up a steak burrito deluxe there, which is my traditional order. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very flavorful burrito if you get the deluxe version with guacamole and sour cream. You've got like a lot of different flavors in there. I wouldn't say that the distribution of ingredients was ideal. All the beans kind of ended up together in a handful of bites.
If you have a bite of all beans, that's not a good bite.
It wasn't the worst, but it wasn't the best either. As we've talked about in the past, a key criteria for burritos. I've never really had a taco at Blue Water Taco Grill. Have you had?
I'm sure that I have, but I feel like I'm mostly about the burritos there.
The other thing is, like, their specialty is coastal Mexican and seafood, and I've never ordered seafood there once.
I'm pretty sure that I've ordered shrimp at some point, but
We may just be doing Blue Water wrong. It's entirely possible. But I would say that, you know, in a world before Chipotle was ubiquitous, Blue Water stood out a little bit more.
Look, if there were as many Chipotles in Seattle as there are Blue Waters, I'd be very happy.
I'm pretty sure there has to be as many Chipotles. I mean,
in downtown Seattle? No, probably not.
They're not as concentrated in downtown Seattle, no.
I mean, I can think of like 3 Chipotles in the region.
Really? I'm dubious here.
There's probably one north. There's the one straight up downtown Seattle. There's Bellevue. There's Renton. Which other ones am I forgetting?
Well, you just named more than 3.
I guess there are 2 in SeaTac. There's the one on the SeaTac on South Center Parkway and the one in the mall.
That's Tequila, actually, that you're thinking of. But yes, there are 4 within the greater like South End region. 1 in West Seattle and, let's see, 3 in the downtown slash Capitol Hill area, and then
oh yeah, there's the Capitol one. Okay, there are a lot of Chipotle's.
Yeah,
Chipotle's. We live in an amazing world. Cube 93 is back, and there are a lot of Chipotle's.
We're gonna discuss Chipotle on the pod at some point, but that is not topic for today
with a special guest.
I haven't specifically approached this guest about it, but I'm confident.
Very special guest.
I'm confident that's going to take place.
I'm curious to find out if any ingredients are tours de force. Is that the proper way to say it?
That seems right.
Not tour de forces?
Quarter pounders with cheese.
No.
Pounder with cheese?
You said it should be quarter pounder with cheese. That's you.
Did I say that?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
You said that proper pluralization would mean that it was quarter pounder with cheeses.
Well, I got to
stick.
Is
that correct?
I don't think I said that, but I got to stick with
you
that take if I
said it. You
said
that. Everybody says quarter pounders with cheese, and that you said that it should be quarter pounder with cheeses.
But quarters pounder with cheese is the funniest of those. Anyways.
Tours de force.
We've gone off topic. So I think in a world before burritos were as ubiquitous as they were, Blue Water stood out a little bit more because it's a better quality burrito than if you go to a taco truck and get a burrito. You're probably not going to get as quality a burrito because that's not what they specialize in.
Okay. I just don't know if I can agree with that.
Because you're probably getting refried beans in your burrito.
Look, can we just end the refried bean?
Just in general?
Yeah.
You're putting an end to it? I don't know that you can do that unilaterally.
It's been fried once. It doesn't need to be fried again.
I'm pretty sure you can. So I would say the Blue Water is a notch above Taco Del Mar, which is
Taco Del Mar's. Taco Del's Mar.
Droid S's everywhere. Taco Del Mar, which would be its closest like competitor as Coastal Mexican in the Seattle area, chain Coastal Mexican, which will not be reviewed as part of our search for Seattle's best burrito / tacos.
But I like that we're doing Chipotle. It's almost like we're an episode of Ugly Delicious and we have to acknowledge like the mainstream thing.
Okay. Do you have any additional thoughts to offer on Blue Water?
I haven't been there in years, to be honest.
Really?
It has been. I have not been there since I worked at the Vera Project. However, I went there on my last day at the Vera Project about 4 years ago.
Oh, your final meal was there.
Yeah, last meal. And that was the last time that I went to Taco Del Mar 4 years ago.
But now I think
I don't really look back on it fondly, though. I mean, that meal was fine, but just the idea of...
That's where you went?
Blue Water, I look at it and I think, it's just fine. Like, I have no need to go there in the last 4 years. I've been to Chipotle 100 times in those 4 years. I've been to Tacos Chuki's 50 times.
50 times? That seems like an exaggeration.
All right, that might be. I've probably been to Tacos Chuki's 20 times.
Maybe. Yeah, I got to say, this time when it was difficult because I had to walk by Dick's to go to Blue Water from Kiarita, and it was like, man, I really just want to go to Dick's.
Yeah.
Like, it would be delicious.
Turn back the other way and eat at Dick's.
Yes. Even though the ladies were in the mood for some Mexican eating.
And it's true, Mexican eating.
Yep. So, yeah, I think just in a world where quality burritos are more available, it just doesn't stand out the same way.
What's the grade?
82.
Wow, 82.
Yeah.
I don't really. Given my 4-year-old brain, I'm going to give it an 80.
Okay.
My 4-year-old memory.
I mean, you're...
Not my 4-year-old brain.
We know a lot about 4-year-old brains. Hopefully it's not.
Look, at some point, we're going to have Luca on here, Baby Fantasy Genius, to review Tacos Chuki's and Taco Time. Maybe he'll be a guest on the inaugural Talking Taco Time. Talking Taco Time.
We can just do a deep voice. We're not ripping off House of Carbs. I'm sorry. House of Carbs. Like that.
Maybe he should be a guest on the inaugural Talkin' Taco Time. I would love to hear what he prefers between Tacos Chuki's and Taco Time. Look, that kid's got a pretty good palate.
He does. Can I tell you, I went to Tacos Chuki's over the weekend.
Yes.
And we've got a bonus review here.
Ooh.
Because in lieu of the usual Pelton Cast special, or the Pelton Cast triple double.
No, it's the Pelton Cast. So you and I disagree about this. We should be looking for things to be called the Pelton Cast.
Fine. I think it's better if there's something else with it. But in addition to the usual two baby burritos, and I did get one house taco. I don't get the two Tecates generally. I prefer the unless
the Mollusk Brewing.
Yes, the Mollusk Brewing house like cervezas brand, which really hit the spot.
I crunched the numbers on whether that was a good deal or not, and I've determined it's not bad.
Yeah. But is my fourth food item, instead of getting the second house taco, I got a mulita. because as I espoused on the pod last week, I'm now a bigger fan of Melitas than I am of tacos. But it turns out not the case at Tacos Chuquis.
Wow! What? So the Melita was lacking at Tacos Chuquis?
I don't think there was any cheese on it, for one thing.
Whoa!
Which is...
So you found the item that they do badly.
I mean, look, I'm not going to say they did it badly, but it was basically the same as if you had ordered a non-house taco, except one of the tortillas was on top instead of on the bottom. Huh. Instead of having two on the bottom, you had one on top and one on the bottom. So it was just more, because the beauty of the cheese is that it puts the meat in place. So this way,
cheese is always holding everything in place. It's
the
great.
Meat was just falling out as I was trying to eat it. It just became a more inconvenient to eat taco, and I didn't get the pineapple that's in the house taco.
Wow.
So it was a disappointment.
Tacos Chuquis Melita is just an inconvenient taco.
Nothing wrong with it. I'm just saying it's just not as good as their other stuff.
Wait, let me rephrase what I was saying by the thing that they do badly. The Melita at Tacos Chuquis is the item there that is not the best in Seattle. Because right now they have the best burrito in Seattle and the best tacos in Seattle as far as we're concerned. But they do not have the best Melitas in Seattle. Who has it? Was it El Camion or the Taco Bus?
I think El Camion at this point.
God, El Camion's good. I've done a little bit of pining. That's how you know you have a good taco place.
Friend of the pod, Stephen Cohen, who congrats on starting at The Athletic this week, tweeted last week, like, if you're not eating gorditas at El Camion, what are you even doing?
I saw that.
And I got to reply to him, well, I'm eating Melitas there. That's the answer.
You also got a gordita. I wanted to respond to him or quote him, burrito season approaching or welcome to the resistance, something like that.
This is not technically Peltoncast changing lives, but I did want to note this briefly while we were talking about Tacos Chuquis.
Mild life change. Okay.
Probably not a listener, but just a follower, tweeted me a couple weeks ago. Driving up from Portland, I have about 48 hours near Boeing Field next weekend. Where should I eat? Oh, I guess he probably is a listener because he said I have the taco bus on the list so far. So assuming that is the case, thanks for listening, Tyler Roberts, friend of the pod, loyal listener. So I suggested Loretta's, obviously, Tacos Chuquis in Beacon Hill, and then Sisters and Brothers, which I don't know if we've talked about on the podcast with their Nashville hot chicken, but perhaps we did at some point. And he replied to me after making this trip on Monday, on Sunday, all three were awesome. The line at Chuquis and Capitol Hill on Cinco de Mayo was crazy, though. Thanks for your help.
That's a life change. He went to all three locations.
That's a satisfied Peltoncast listener right there.
If you go to all three locations, I feel like that's your life has been changed.
I also
for the
like,
better.
If you're coming, we're happy to customize our recommendations for you. I don't know what's the food website that does that?
Customizes your recommendations for
you?
Yeah,
there's one of them.
Definitely not Rich Joe's website.
It was on House of Carbs. Like, you text them and they'll give you a recommendation.
Really?
I'm willing to do that on Twitter.
You have to pay for this service?
No, I don't think
you can text a website and they'll customize the recommendations for you.
I don't think you have to pay for it.
Wow. If you texted me, there's like a 30% chance I'm responding. That's true. Personalized recommendations.
No, there's a 30% chance you're responding to me if I text you. That's what it is.
Respond 100% of the time if I want you to get me food.
All right, so this week, I think, fingers crossed.
Wow, this is the week.
I think we're finally getting to marination.
Wow. Like I said, we've been circling marination for a long time.
Yeah, we're ready. Time is right.
I'm so ready. What if my preferred order at marination is a slider?
It's the same. So I'm going to have to mix it up a little bit.
I definitely eat tacos there. I'll give you the perfect marination order. And... It's two Aloha pork sliders and two Call Me Beef tacos.
Interesting. No, you do not tend to favor, as I do, the Spam slider.
No, I don't think I've ever eaten Spam in my entire life.
I mean, we must have eaten it as children at some point.
Let me give you a pre-review of... See, this is something that you're going to disagree with me on. A pre-review of marination. They have the best jalapenos I've ever eaten in my entire life.
I mean, I don't disagree. I just... to have no take on it since I don't eat jalapenos.
You don't eat the jalapenos on it?
No.
They're so flavorful, but it's like a fruity jalapeno. Maybe they're pickled, the jalapenos that they use.
I would assume that's how they would create flavor.
They're excellent jalapenos.
All right.
Marination.
I'll take your word for it.
If you're going there, that to me, I'm pretty sure I have that right. It's been a while. Two Aloha pork sliders with the Hawaiian bun, so it's sweet. And then the two Colby beef tacos, and the beef is good. Oh, you like that Colby beef.
I don't dislike the Colby beef.
But you're going spam. Spam musubi or whatever?
Well, musubi is a form of where it's between rice.
Oh.
But yes, it's just a spam slider. That's
spam
all
sliders. All right. Well, I'm ready for it.
All right, let's talk sports.
I want to talk sisters and brothers, though. Look, we talked about it just for a second.
Okay. When was the last time you were at sisters and brothers? Because it's been a while for me.
I just wanted to explain what it was if people haven't had it. Because this is the only, as far as we know, Nashville hot chicken restaurant in Seattle.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's like 4 minutes from your house.
It's probably like six.
Directly under Boeing Field, you can hear the planes flying over you behind your vocals. When you're at Sisters and Brothers, it's nice. They have outdoor seating. You can see the planes landing, but that chicken is hot.
Don't be a hero there. Yeah. Don't think, oh, I'm going with medium.
It really is crazy. I can stand heat in a lot of places, but like the mild at Sisters and Brothers, I need like four Rainiers to get that down.
But definitely delicious.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
All right.
I need to get back there. All right. Let's talk about the NBA playoffs where it's not been going well for Trust the Pelton
Do
Cast,
not our Sixers spinoff. No, look, my question for you is, should we trust the Pelton Cast?
I mean, are you asking whether the Sixers have a chance to become the first team ever to come back from 3-0 in a series?
That is exactly what I'm asking.
I mean, they have a chance, you know. So you're telling me there's a chance?
They've been the favorite in every single game so far?
They have been the favorite in every single game. They were favored by six when they were down 3-0
really
in the series.
Start betting on the Celtics?
I mean, no, you probably shouldn't because there's a reason. Like, what Vegas is seeing lines up with my analysis of the series going in and then even over the course of the series. I tweeted this earlier. The Sixers have had better shot quality as measured by the second spectrum data that we have access to at ESPN in every single game of the series and have consistently underperformed it in their actual shooting, even in game four that they won pretty comfortably.
Why is this happening?
I mean, part of it probably is the Celtics' defense is very good, but I don't know. Part of it is just they're missing shots.
They just happen to be missing shots in the series.
Yeah.
Boston's just getting lucky.
Somehow, so when we changed our affiliation from the Blazers after the first round to the Sixers, it transferred the Blazers' terrible shooting from that series.
What is our affiliation?
Directly onto
the Sixers.
Lose.
What is our affiliation in the Western Conference Finals?
I don't know at that point. We no longer have strong
feelings.
I hate
both of the teams in the East, and I kind of like both of the teams in the West. I think maybe my allegiance is with the Rockets.
I mean, it'd be cool to see Chris Paul win.
It's going to be Warriors in four. Clean sweep for the Warriors.
Well, I was just excited the Sixers won a game. It's been a while since the team we wanted to win won a game. What do these
That was nice. That was nice to see. So they just haven't been hitting shots.
I mean, that's a lot of it. It feels like they're forcing a lot of shots and that their shot selection has not been great. But again, the numbers don't back that up. They say their shots have actually been quite good. And, you know, there are some factors you can't capture. But what I have found in my research is that the shot quality is very predictive going forward, even with the factors it can't capture, except in this series. But what did happen is the Celtics, after their game one hot shooting, have come very much back to earth the last few games.
The Celtics?
Yes. And then TJ McConnell, Tej, changed the series.
I mean, I'm all about Tej and Jage. Has Markelle Fultz played at all?
No, he will
when
not
When they
play.
Went down 3-0, it was not a normal down 3-0, I felt.
Right, I mean, they lost in overtime in game three and had lost by a couple points in game two.
But didn't it feel like they could have used a shakeup a little bit?
The shakeup was starting TJ McConnell. That was just shakeup. And playing TJ McConnell as much as you are, now there's even less room for Markelle Fultz.
Ugh. All right. Well, we're not going to see Markelle Fultz again until next year.
It seems very unlikely that we will.
Maybe in Summer League.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
Right, he'll play in Summer League.
I don't know. I'm curious to see whether he will or not.
What has he got to lose?
I hope so.
What would you put percentage chances of Philadelphia winning the series, though?
Maybe 10?
That's pretty high for a team down 3-1, right?
Yeah, but as Bill Simmons noted on his podcast today, they were still only 6.5-1 in Vegas when they were down 3-0.
That's crazy.
That's going too far because it's so hard to win on the road in game seven.
Sixers of all teams. Like, can you imagine that the Sixers would be a favored in a game down 3-0 in a series of all teams?
Well, I can imagine that. But favored on the road in game five down 3-1.
Wow. What is going on with Joel Embiid, though? Because, I mean, I feel like when I've watched these games, you know, because I watch the games, not I don't know that you don't, but
yes.
Joel Embiid just has not looked good to me in the series, particularly defensively.
Well, defensively, he's been asked to do too much. I mean, Al Horford, I think they're maybe a little too afraid of Al Horford's three. I think you've got to be willing to sacrifice some threes to take away Terry Rozier on the drive. But the adjustment they made then is they put him in Marcus Morris at the end of game three and then throughout game four, and that'll probably be what they do going forward.
Instead of Horford?
Yes. And so the Celtics don't like to run pick and roll with Morris the same way that they do with Horford, or pick and pop specifically.
So why would they be playing Marcus Morris and not Al Horford? Al Horford looked good in
those
games.
They're playing both of those guys.
Oh, they're playing both of them.
Ersan Ilyasova is defending Horford now at the end of games in particular.
All right.
So that's the adjustment. I mean, the big thing is that they keep throwing him the ball on the block, and Horford is just stoning him in the post. And it's been a really horrendous play for them.
For who?
For the Sixers.
Horford's just defeating Joel Embiid in the post.
He's taking away all of his easy looks. Joel Embiid, before game four, was shooting 25% on post-ups.
Jesus Christ. I mean, Al Horford has to be like, I don't like giving credit to Celtics players, but Al Horford's awesome.
He's very good, yes.
He's just like so deceptively good at basketball.
And it's like so hard for people who just think that ability is measured by points and rebounds per game to understand Al Horford.
He really is. That's the weird thing is like, you like Al Horford, right?
Yeah.
And he's like a watch the game star.
Well, I don't know if you're aware of this. I do actually watch many games.
No, I'm saying that's the thing. It's like the people who would assume that you don't watch the game would probably be saying that you wouldn't like Al Horford because he doesn't show up statistically in the same sort of way.
But the eye test, when people say the eye test, all they mean is points per game. That's all they mean.
But to me, the eye test, I see Al Horford. But that's what they mean. And he looks good.
The eye test is just points per game.
I don't know if that's
all
true.
It is.
I don't know if that's true.
It's okay. It's at least 95%.
You don't need your eyes to see points per game.
That's the irony. Irony.
Wow. You really think that the eye test is just points per game?
All right. Think of people who like the eye test crowd likes more than statistical analysis does. DeMar DeRozan, Kobe Bryant, Allen Iverson. Who's a little bit too harshly treated by statistical analysis. I mean, and Kobe is obviously an amazing player. Like, DeRozan was had a great regular season.
You're bringing a lot of hate here.
But I'm saying, who's...
I feel like you should, target some lower people.
I mean, I love the guy. May listen to the podcast. You never know. But Jamal Crawford? He's very much a, why don't you watch the game and see his sick crossover? And it's like, okay, that's great. Why don't you watch the other end, the defensive part of the court?
I don't like to pay attention to that part of the game.
Most people don't, which is why they're so unhappy about not having Kyle Kuzma in my top 10 rookies in terms of future potential.
Anyway, Al Horford is good.
Yes.
Everything he does is good.
Yes, he is. Speaking of the conference finals briefly, did you see that the Las Vegas Golden Knights reached the conference finals in their first year as an expansion team? They are setting expectations way too high for the future Seattle expansion team.
Look, I mean, what they're doing is not repeatable.
It is not. It's a once in a life. It's a once in ever thing.
They happen to be a very successful expansion team. That doesn't mean that all expansion teams are going to be very successful.
Right.
I'm trying to think. Well, I guess both of the 90s football expansion teams were pretty good pretty quickly, the Jaguars.
They
the
both
Panthers.
Reached the conference finals in their second year.
It was pretty crazy.
Or the championships in that case. Yes, but both of them, it was pretty fluky that they got there. They weren't actually the second best team in their conference. And again, there was their second year.
I mean, still, to reach that level that quickly. But what the Golden Knights are doing should not be considered a model for what the Seattle Sockeyes, or whatever they may be named.
Yes, it's not a realistic expectation for them. With that in the books, don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
Okay, I gotta put on my Canadian tuxedo here.
Oh, nice.
Okay. Oh, James Paxton, the best and greatest pitcher. He could have struck out more than 20 batters. The big maple went into Canada and threw a no-hitter from Victoria to Saskatchewan. He owns Canada more than LeBron. Oh, James Paxton, we stand and applaud for thee. Oh, James Paxton, we stand and applaud for thee.
Okay, first off, you are aware. aware that Saskatchewan is not on the opposite side of the country from Victoria, right?
Victoria to Saskatchewan.
I think it's like Prince Edward Island, I believe.
Oh, my.
Maybe at least Nova Scotia.
Like I sang on a podcast. You just did it.
You sure did.
Wait, I'm trying to think of it. It's not Prince Edward Island. It's, oh my God, what is that called?
I don't know what it's
called. Google Maps is not loading for me.
It looks like it should be Nova Scotia.
Oh, yeah, Nova Scotia, yeah. Anyway.
Or could be Newfoundland. No, Newfoundland, I guess, is further north, farther east, so.
Do you have anything to add to these hot takes?
James Paxton was amazing. To follow up the 16 strikeout game where he was pulled early, and, you know, you could argue that justified that decision by the fact that he was able to come back and be so effective in his next start. He was so fresh and was able to no-hit his, not really hometown, but countryman, the Toronto
Blue
Jays.
From the west side, like TQ. But to the whole wide west side.
I don't know if you've noticed this. Oftentimes, there are a lot of Toronto Blue Jays fans who come down from Vancouver to attend Mariners games.
I have noticed that.
When the Blue Jays are here. And I feel like...
I've never been more provincial than when the Mariners are playing the Blue Jays in Seattle.
Exactly. Which is why it feels like especially awesome that Paxton threw a no-hitter against the Blue Jays. Like, if it had been here against those Blue Jays fans, it would have been all the better. But in Canada, it was good, too.
Well, he'll throw a no-hitter next time because he's never giving up a hit ever again. I mean, to me...
That should have been part of the hot take.
I have a certain disappointment that it wasn't a perfect game.
Exactly. So I got tipped off to this no-hitter by Third Pelton brother Mina Kimes tweeting about it, I think, after the sixth inning. And
what was she tweeting, though? Because was it cryptic? It has to be cryptic.
Oh, it's got to be cryptic.
Yeah, like, it's funny. Like, I don't care at all about baseball, but, like, the rules of not talking about no-hitters is the only thing that I care about.
Like, I get the people who are like, oh, it's a dumb, you know, dumb, like, superstition and that sort of thing.
Who are these
but
people? Monsters!
I don't
all
like
of them.
Ignoring it entirely, but I like... like talking around it. Like Aaron Goldschmidt is the Mariners announcer, right? Does that check out? Is that
sure.
right? He was
certainly
like kept saying there are only three players have reached base and they've all done so via walk or something like that. Like that I enjoy. Mina's tweet was, don't want to jinx anything, but you might want to check out Pames Jackson and the Meattle Sereners right now.
Okay, yeah, I'll accept that. Yep. You just can't use the term, right? Like, if you texted me about this game, and you were like, are you seeing what's going on in the Mariners game?
That's what I said.
And I said no.
Mariners hot takes are the one place where we literally do not watch the games.
Yes. I did not see it. Did you watch a single out of this?
Yeah, I watched it. So I flipped over. It was halftime when Mina tweeted that of the first game tonight, Rockets Jazz. So I watched the seventh inning during halftime and then had it on second screen on my laptop for the eighth and ninth inning.
Oh, you got to have a second screen.
Yeah. I mean, Third Pelton brother Ben B was all like, who would watch a regular season MLB game or a playoff NBA game?
It's so busy celebrating the Capitals winning.
He's been surprisingly restrained on Twitter, I would say, other than noting that Ovechkin and Chris Paul both got to the conference finals for the first time.
They're
going
to lose to the Golden Knights.
I mean, if they do that, they'll be in the cup finals. That'll be fine.
We'll be fine. It'll hurt even more.
It'll be good enough.
And, you know, the Seahawks, they made it to the 1 yard line. Like, really, I mean, they should have been excited about that.
All right. Fair take.
Just about getting that close that matters.
But I was able to do both of those things anyway, was my point. Mm-hmm. I was able to both see Donovan Mitchell score 22 points in a quarter and James Paxton throw a no-hitter.
Donovan Mitchell is doing surprisingly amazing things in games that do not matter at all. I mean, the games matter, but his performance doesn't seem to matter.
Well, he also had 2 points in the first half, so that was a bit of a factor. It was an up-and-down game for Mitchell, who left due to injury, and that's when the Rockets pulled away. Paxton, the sixth no-hitter in Mariners history. I would say that he joins the likes of Randy Johnson, Chris Bosio, the combined no-hitter started by Kevin Millwood, Felix Hernandez, who of course threw the only perfect game in franchise history, and Hisashi Iwakuma. But the answer is really that they joined him.
This was an historic no-hitter, right? This was the first no-hitter thrown by a Canadian in Canada while wearing a Canadian tuxedo.
No, two-thirds of that checkout. It would have been great if you had worn that to the game, though. Also in Mariners news, since we last talked, Ichiro has transitioned to the role of special assistant to the chairman for the remainder of the 2018 season, which is the most incredibly creatively worded thing I have ever
He's
seen.
He's not retiring. That's the thing.
Well, it's a lot of the talk seems to like center on the possibility that he might play in this 2019 series the Mariners are going to play in Japan.
So they're just keeping him around to play in this one Japanese series?
No, I don't think they're necessarily just keeping him. I'm sure they value his leadership in the clubhouse, which is why he'll continue to dress for games beforehand and take batting practice.
The Ichiro story has become sad quickly.
I mean, on the heels of the Wright Thompson feature coming into the season about like Ichiro's dedication to routine into the game, like it very much feels like this is a guy who's struggling with that transition.
Yeah, he's literally wearing the clothes as if he could play but cannot play.
It's
weird.
It's not great. We already talked about Ichiro when he came back to the Mariners. I'm not sure there's anything new to say now because you already had trashed Ichiro sufficiently at that point. I am going to look back fondly on the Ichiro era, if in fact it is done.
Which Ichiro era? This one?
No, I mean the original
Ichiro. Striking out and ruining James Paxton's 16 strikeouts?
That would be pretty good if you like set a montage to I Will Remember You of Ichiro's at-bats in this year.
Good riddance, time of your life.
Well,
just Ichiro with his like two slap singles that he got. Did he have an extra base hit as a Mariner this time? I don't think he walked. I'm pretty sure his on base percentage was equal to or lesser than his batting average.
That I think it was equal to is my recollection. I can get that word out. It turns out he did not have an extra base hit, but did have three walks, giving him the thrilling slash line of 205, 255, 205.
So exciting that the Mariners brought him back. Thrilled about that decision.
You know.
Hey, let me just throw this out there. You said that I made this too much about A-Rod the last time Ichiro came back. If A-Rod were here, he would have an extra base hit by now.
Yeah, that's probably true. That checks out.
He would be wearing a super tight shirt instead of wearing his jersey in the dugout with maybe the top two buttons open.
Be careful how you talk about my coworker. Anything else on the Mariners? No. Okay. We turn our attention to the Sounders. There's not going to be any airing of grievances this week, but I don't think that Sounders fans are any more satisfied with this past
outing. You can just run back your previous grievances.
On Saturday afternoon, they hosted the Columbus Crew, a match that was dramatically changed in the 15th minute when Columbus was reduced to 10 man.
15th minute?
Yes. After video assisted review revealed a high kick by Pedro Santos that earned him a red card and had him sent off at that point. The Crew shifted into a 5-3-1 formation. And from that point on, well, overall for the game, the Sounders had 65% of possession. They attempted 17 shots. One of them was on goal.
Oh, my God.
And did not score, obviously.
How do you not score when you have 75 minutes up a man?
I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of complaint about the creativity of the Sounders' attack and their finishing ability. They were without Nicola Lodero in this game, who was a last-minute scratch with a mysterious foot injury that Brian Schmetzer described after the game as significant, but really did not offer any more details about.
Great. If it were the Seahawks, his career would be over.
Well, we're going to get to that in a second. That's not really funny. I mean, yes, this is all true, but at the same time, it feels like this is a match I've seen 1,000 times.
Is it?
Yeah. Where like the one team loses a man on the road and then all of a sudden they're like, look, we may not score a goal, but you damn sure are not scoring a goal either. And they just put 10 guys in the box and like force you to fire crosses and try to shoot from long range, like Clint Dempsey shooting from outside the box. And that's like all you can do because soccer is problematic in that way, especially when a team doesn't have any interest in scoring a goal. And the Columbus did have a couple of decent chances getting Zardes out on the break in the first few minutes after they went down to 10. But by the second half, they had zero interest in even possessing the ball or scoring a goal.
I mean, when they are a man down, getting a point out of this match is a huge win for Columbus.
Oh, yeah.
And Columbus is one of the worst teams in the MLS, right?
I mean, they've been struggling this year. I wouldn't say that.
But they're one of the worst teams currently.
I guess so. I mean, the Sounders are one of the worst teams. I have to break it to you.
The worst team.
I think they're tied for it.
I mean, there's another team that has 1 point. Or no, the Sounders are at more than 1 point now.
They do. They have 5 points.
Okay.
It reminded me a lot of the game at Vancouver in the playoffs last year, the first leg of the first round of the playoffs against Vancouver, where the Sounders without Clint Dempsey due to suspension, and they were like, look, we're just going to go home with a 0-0 draw and take our chances at home. And that's what they did. I mean, I think probably Vancouver had more dangerous chances in that game, and Stephen Fry was called upon more times than Zach Steffen was in this game for Columbus, but I just can't. I think the Sounders got screwed by, like, it made me wonder if you had the choice, like, and there was some sort of other penalty you could convey here, like whether you would rather not have the player sent off. I mean, it decreases your chances of losing, but it also, I think, increases your chances of drawing.
That's an interesting thought, actually, if you could choose whether a player was sent off or not, because it's almost like the expected points in the match decrease.
Yeah, because a draw is because of the way that soccer is set up to incentivize teams to play for the win, because you get more points, relatively more, you add more points by winning than you lose by losing as compared to a draw.
I still think that if the Sounders were playing to the best of their abilities, they would have found a way to get a goal in this game.
I mean, probably. But also, soccer is really random, and so process and results are wildly disconnected, as we've talked about in the past.
What's going on at the Sounders this weekend?
It's not this weekend. It's tonight.
Listen
to this podcast as it comes out, because the real downside of drawing this match is that all of a sudden the schedule gets extraordinarily difficult this week. Wednesday, the Sounders at Toronto FC in a rematch of the last two MLS Cups. They'll return to the site of last year's horrors in the MLS Cup final, where they were beaten badly by Toronto FC, but also the site of the heroics of Stephen Fry 2 years ago in their 0-0 draw against a really good attacking Toronto FC team, where they tried not to concede a goal.
Were not a man down, but yes.
No, they were not, but they played very similarly. Toronto FC also, like the Sounders, off to
very
a slow
interesting
start.
And they have everybody right now. They've got Jovinko. They have Jose Altidore.
I think so.
Okay.
They've taken just 7 points from their 7 matches, putting them 10th in the Eastern Conference. All 7 points have come so far. In their 4 home matches, they have not earned a point in any of their 3 road games, going 0-3 and 0 in those matches.
These are Ichiro-like stats.
But Toronto, as you might guess, has been really unlucky this season in terms of expected goal differential. According to American Soccer Analysis' version of these stats, they have the second largest negative difference between their expected goal difference and their actual goal difference in the league, the Sounders being 4th in that category. So they're still 3rd in 538 Soccer Power Index, despite this slow start. And
we'll see what it means. It feels like Toronto is a little bit more on the trajectory that the Sounders would have been on last season, but maybe the Sounders have entered a new tier and they might. Okay. What would you put the Sounders' chances, granting that it's a very long season, right now, what would you say their chances of making the playoffs are?
About 60%.
60%? The Sounders' chances of making the playoffs with 5 points right now, you think are 60%?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little more optimistic than 538 is.
538 thinks they're close to 60%?
I think they're about 50-50 on 538.
Wow!
By the way, Toronto seems to have had a lot of players miss time due to injuries. Josie's only played 3 matches thus far. Jovinko, 5.
Also, are you aware that the World Cup is happening this summer?
I mean, if the U.S. and Italy both don't play, is the World Cup really happening?
We have no rooting interest in this World Cup. In a little more than a month, the World Cup is happening, and I have not seen a single bit of advertising for it.
I misremembered, by the way. Well, Fox Sports 1 has been playing a lot of ads for it.
What are you watching on Fox Sports? Is that where you... Is that,
I mean...
Is there you're watching Husky softball matches?
No, sadly, those would probably be on Pac-12 Network. I mean, the Sounders games often have been on FS1.
That you watch that I don't?
Yes. They're doing a partnership with 23andMe, and it's like, find your heritage. You can find out what to root for. Because
wow, that's what we have to do?
America.
That's where we're at?
But then you find your heritage, and it turns out it's Italian, and look, you're screwed then, too.
God, or you're screwed that it's not Italian. You just think back to your children's names.
Anyway,
it should have been Ron, George, and Greg or something.
Anyway, 538 has the Sounders at 58% to make the playoffs. So there you go. There you go, good sir. But anyways, after this match on Wednesday, the Sounders have to fly all the way across the country to Toronto.
Yes.
Between playing Sunday or Saturday and then come back and play again on Sunday in Portland. This is an insane schedule. It makes no sense to have to do this, to play a midweek game in one of the most distant places.
It's pretty weird.
And especially because these are both nationally TV game, televised games. The Toronto game is on FS1.
That's what we're going to be seeing. Maybe I'll watch that one. Maybe I'll see some ads for the World Cup.
Whereas Sunday's match at Portland is on ESPN. So both marquee matchups for the league. I mean, this is Seattle-Portland rivalry. One of the biggest, if not the biggest. El Trafico is probably pretty big now in the New York, that's the LAFC.
I know, I'm saying. They've played one match against each other.
Yeah, but in terms of like national interest, it's pretty out there. But anyway, Seattle-Portland.
This is a hated rivalry.
It is.
Look, we hate Portland when we don't love Portland.
That's a good point. This is the 100th matchup between the Sounders and Timbers.
We hate Canada also when we don't love James Paxton.
Exactly. But maybe James Paxton's self-hating Canadian?
No.
That's why he's throwing no-hitters against them?
Who's thrown up for the West Side?
The 100th incarnation of this matchup dating back to 1975 across the NASL, across the A-League, across the, what was it, the USL? Was that USL. The last one they were in? And now back in MLS.
This is the 100th matchup.
Yeah.
Between whatever Seattle team's is named and whatever Portland's team is named.
Well, no, I think they're strictly counting games where they were called Sounders and Timbers.
They were always the Timbers in all these leagues.
I think so.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean,
if you'd asked me the first time that they were called the Timbers, I would have guessed it was when they're in the MLS. No. I would have guessed it was when their manager was wearing a suit unnecessarily.
You know, Italian managers are known for wearing a lot of suits, so I wouldn't say unnecessarily.
Like in Portland, nobody wears suits in Portland.
I wore a suit in Portland to the Blazers playoff games.
You looked very out of place.
I probably did. I don't know if they're counting the U.S. Open Cup matchups. In SoundersFC.com has like a history of the rivalry, and the red card wedding is prominently
the red
featured
card
there.
Wedding. Wow, I'm so happy I was at that game.
Yeah, what a memorable game to be at.
Honestly, like I just want to be at historic games, good or bad.
My rule of thumb is if you're going to be bad, be historically bad.
Yeah. The red, is that the commonly known name for that game?
I mean, to the extent that people are talking specifically about that game, you see a name, yes.
About a U.S. Open Cup match that happened in Tequila?
I mean, the Sounders ended up with seven players. Seven players. Not all of those players.
I was leaving and police were driving in, right? Yeah.
Not all of those players were red carded.
We weren't recording a podcast when this was happening, right?
No, we weren't.
I mean, we literally were driving out. We left early. Because things were getting ugly at the red card wedding.
It was also very late for Baby Fantasy Genius to be out watching a soccer match.
We had two babies at that point.
That sounds right.
This was before the third baby. And we left because things were turning ugly in the stands.
So, oh, in the stands? I didn't realize that.
No, people were ready to riot. I honestly thought that the fans were going to storm the field.
I mean, it seems like when three players have been sent off with red cards, it does probably come with the territory.
And as we were leaving, police were coming in droves. Like, police were expecting a riot at that game. And you're at Starfire, this tiny stadium, so you're, like, on top of the match. Literally, the ball, like, I held the ball at that match. The ball that they were playing with, I touched during the match because it was kicked to me, and I threw it back. This is how small Starfire is. I mean, are you aware of this?
Yeah, you mentioned that.
It's weird.
I mean, I think that can happen at CenturyLink Field. It's just unlikely you would have tickets good enough to do it.
I mean, the police are not going to expect a riot to happen at CenturyLink Field, though. The distance between the field and the stands is so great that people aren't going to breach the field in the same kind of way. But at Starfire, it felt like people could get on that field easily.
Yeah.
It was just like a little bit scary being there. It was fun. Loved every second of it.
It's good to be able to say you were there. So the Timbers are fourth in the West so far with 11 points from 8 matches. They actually are tied for 6th in SPI with the Sounders. But that's pretty different from the expected goal differential analysis on American Soccer Analysis, which has them as fortunate to even be have a -1 goal differential so far this season. So it'll be interesting, a case where the Sounders come in rated as the better team, but you know, home field advantage and results thus far favoring the Timbers.
This is in Portland.
Yes.
They're going to lose.
It seems likely. I mean, if the Sounders were to get 2 points from this weekend, this week, that would be a huge success.
I feel like a point would be nice.
Yes. So it's a rough time still for the Sounders. Better news for the Seattle Reign, who beat the rival Portland Thorn 3-2 in a wild match last week and getting the winner in the 75th minute.
The 100th match between the Reign and the Thorns.
Still got a few to go to get there. They have not been playing for 40 years across four different leagues. The Reign now have 10 points from their five matches, putting them second in NWSL. Despite playing four of those five on the road, they will be back home this Saturday to host Sky Blue FC.
Let me guess where Sky Blue FC plays. Do you know this?
We discussed this on the pod, I think, at one point, didn't we?
I think they play in...
I know I looked it up at one point, but I don't even remember anymore.
I think they play in Salt Lake City.
Oh, I think that's right, actually. I think that is right. Nope, Piscataway Township, New Jersey.
Oh, damn it! I should have known it was Piscataway Township, New Jersey.
There was a team that moved to Salt Lake City this year. That would be... Now they've now been named the Utah Royals.
Okay.
Utah Royals.
All right. I should have. Next time, I'll guess Piscataway Township, New Jersey.
Also, in women's sports, the Seattle Storm kicking off their 2018 season with their preseason opener against the Phoenix Mercury earlier Tuesday, beating Phoenix 73-69. Strong debut for first-round pick Jordan Canada.
Shouts to Canada. Huge day for Canada today.
It's true. Good point. Came off the bench with 15 points, 5 steals, and 3 assists in her first game. The Storm will face the Mercury again Saturday in Phoenix to wrap up the preseason and then play the first two regular season games against the Mercury.
There are only two teams in the WNBA.
It's not true. There are 12 of them.
Is Jordan Canada a point guard?
Yes.
So she may actually be the heir apparent to Sue Bird.
She's looked very good from what I've seen so far during training camp in the preseason. So, right. So far, so good on that front. The home opener for the Storm coming up on May the 20th. And, of course, we'll have a full season preview before then. In UW Sports, baseball took 2 of 3 at Arizona State to improve to 13-8 in Pac-12 play. They are home for UCLA this weekend in a key series. The Bruins come in at 14-7, one game ahead of the Huskies in the Pac-12 standings. Meanwhile, softball finished up the regular season by sweeping Oregon State last weekend. They will finish fourth in the Pac-12, barring something crazy this weekend, because the rest of the Pac-12 is still in action. They have a schedule with an odd number of teams, so there has to be one team that has a bye each
weekend. Who is the team that plays softball?
That doesn't play softball?
Is there a team that doesn't play softball in the normal Pac-12?
Yeah, there are 9, or 11, I guess it is.
Who is it?
Wazoo.
They don't play softball?
Yeah.
God, I hate them.
Or maybe three teams don't play softball because they've only played eight series. So
Wazoo,
I guess there must be three teams
play
that don't.
Softball of all schools. Come on.
Anyway, softball fifth in the coaches' poll.
It's kind of crazy. Wait, they finished fourth in the Pac-12, but fifth overall in the country.
So two of the teams ahead of them in the standings, three of the top five teams in the country are from the Pac-12. I mean, I've always said we're a softball conference, and
it's like a hydroplanes from Seattle, right?
Got a little bit like that. Although they don't tend to actually win the national championship all that often. Usually it's just like some random school from the Southeast will win the national championship.
There's West Coast biased in softball voting?
No, it's just like they're all really good, but none of them wins the championship any given year. We'll see if they can change that this year. But and then Arizona State finished ahead of the Huskies, but are still behind them in the polls. Huh. This is heading into...
Well, congrats to Oklahoma on their softball championship. Yes.
They always get to play it at home. It's no fair. This is heading into the selections show next Sunday, where we'll find out who the Huskies will be playing.
Mark your calendars.
On the men's basketball front, Noah Dickerson was not invited to the NBA pre-draft camp or combine next week. No big surprise there, certainly. The withdrawal deadline is May 30th, 10 days after the conclusion of the combine, and would remain very surprising if Noah Dickerson did not withdraw and return to UW. All right, let's wrap it up by talking about the Seahawks and another departure. This one, not surprising, but still one worth discussing, is the Seahawks waived Cliff Averill with a failed physical designation before last week's rookie camp to create an additional roster spot. Averill will count $1 million against the cap, that being the guarantee in his contract for this season. And, of course, still uncertain whether he'll play after last year's mysterious neck injury. Pete Carroll's comment was, he's been a great leader. He's been a bit of a statesman for us. He always says the right things, stands for the right stuff, and has been a really high character guy that you can always count on. A great competitor in the program. I love him and would love to keep him connected with our club as long as we can, because he's just exactly what you hope to represent you. He's had a great career with us. Averill had an emotional message on the Players Tribune and said this: a lot of people have been asking me if I'm considering retirement, and all I can really say is that I'm working closely with my doctors and that I'm going to make the best decision for myself and my family when the time is right. For now, as my time as a Seahawk comes to an end, I really just want to show my gratitude. But the good news is, Averill's not going far, because KJR announced on Monday. This is a very local radio heavy podcast.
I mean, this was an insane announcement.
That he is joining them as a midday co-host alongside Jason Puckett.
He's retiring, by the way.
It does seem very retiring.
You don't really go from midday co-host to playing in the NFL all that often.
But then you don't go from playing in Major League Baseball to chairman of the special assistant. The special assistant to the chairman, I should say, all that often either. So, weird week on this front.
This is amazing. First off, Cliff Averill is amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
I no longer have any beer left, but we should toast to Cliff Averill.
I've got rosé left for days. Can we get in a time machine here?
Fujikao?
This was the 2012 NFL playoffs. Am I right?
Where the Seahawks couldn't get any pressure against the Falcons?
At the Atlanta Falcons, right?
I mean, it was in January 2013 after the 2012 season, yes.
The Seahawks go into, remind me, Chris Clemens gets injured at Washington, right?
Yeah, tears his ACL on that terrible field.
The Seahawks have no pass rush in this game at Atlanta. And we're watching, and they played great. Like, the comeback by Russell was amazing. It was a fun game to watch. It left us wanting more, right? That was the takeaway from that game overall, was that we just wanted to watch more football after that.
Yep. Wanted to watch more Russell Wilson in particular.
Pretty much the only time that I felt that in my entire life, that I wasn't sick of football by the end of the season. But the number one takeaway that I had from that game was, this is a team that is an excellent defense and a great team overall, but they are missing one thing, and that is an elite pass rush. And especially knowing that Chris Clemens is going to be coming off a torn ACL, right? Chris Clemens' career is more or less done at that point.
Well, he did start most games the following season, but yes.
That offseason, the Seahawks pull a coup. People talk about John Schneider and Pete Carroll as great drafters, right? But going out and signing both Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill to relatively team-friendly contracts won them the Super Bowl the next year.
That's accurate.
Those two players, to me, were the final pieces that they needed to win the Super Bowl. And had they had them in that game against Atlanta, we might be talking about something completely. We might be talking about a team that went to the Super Bowl 3 years in a row.
Yep. It's bizarre that there was a market, like an off season where it's like there wasn't a great market for pass rushers. It's like, what is this world where pass rushers are not valuable?
It was very insane.
But the Seahawks took full benefit of it and got, you know, 4+ seasons from Averill, 5 from Bennett that were just terrific and a key part of their success. Averill, you mentioned, you know, the Super Bowl. In that game, he's credited with the safety because he was the one who got to Peyton Manning first in the end zone on that errant snap on the opening play of the game, and then also hit Manning and forced the errant throw on the Malcolm Smith interception.
Super Bowl MVP Malcolm Smith.
But Cliff Averill was really the MVP.
Really kind of crazy. We should be talking more about how Malcolm Smith was a Super Bowl MVP.
We talked about it on the post-game podcast. I've gone back and listened to it for the Peltoncast Best Of. We definitely talked about it a lot. Averill finishes his career with the Seahawks 10th in team history in sacks with 34.5, and second with 14 forced fumbles.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, he didn't play for the Seahawks that long to be that high in the record books in both of these categories.
Yeah, the fumbles thing blew me away. I figured he would be around there in sacks, but Cliff Averill, a lot of fumbles. He was the NFC Defensive Player of the Month in October 2016 when he had 6.5 sacks in 4 games, finished that season with a career-high 11.5 sacks, and made his only Pro Bowl. And then also, as Pete Carroll alluded to, was the Seahawks 2016 Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year nominee, has spent part of his last 3 offseasons in his native Haiti, building a school there. So
Cliff Averill's undefeated. Right,
I gotta say, it's a tough power ranking for my favorite Haitians between the Big Waz, my buddy Big Waz, and Cliff Averill.
Wow, Rihanna not even ranking.
Not up there with them. Also, is Rihanna Haitian? I'm pretty sure she's not, is she?
She might be from Barbados.
I think that sounds more right.
Sorry. Wyclef Jean not even ranking.
Okay, that's I can go with that.
He's from Haiti. Cliff Averill is undefeated though as a player, right? Like, there's no moment where you didn't love Cliff Averill.
He's got 100% approval rating.
100%. And then he's a sports radio host in Seattle. Like, that's the most amazing transition.
I mean, it happens. Bucky Jacobson is on KJR as well, right?
Yeah, but Bucky Jacobson sucked. Bucky Jacobson was not a good player. Cliff Avril was amazing.
How dare you deny the excitement?
We loved Bucky Jacobson for a moment.
What was the term? Bucky Mania? What was it for that season?
I don't know. Was he from Bellingham?
He was from somewhere in the Northwest.
Cliff Avril is not from the greater Seattle area.
That's a good point. Also, Bucky Jacobson played in the major leagues a long time ago. He didn't like retire and immediately become a talk show host.
I mean, just everything about Cliff Avril is great, right? He was a great player when he came here. You loved everything about him. He performed on the field whenever he was able to play. It was devastating when he was gone. Fucking love Cliff Avril.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of players during this current era who have near 100% approval ratings, right? Like Doug Baldwin, 100% approval rating.
I feel like there might be some fans who yell at players at the practice facility who don't approve of some of these guys.
Not Doug Baldwin, though. You think Doug Baldwin?
Possibly.
Oh, wow. But like Baldwin, Russell Wilson, to me, when you're talking about this pillar of player, Bobby Wagner, Cliff Avril.
Yeah.
Earl Thomas.
Yeah. Earl Thomas, as long as he's not talking about playing for the Cowboys.
Yeah. Cliff Avril never talked about playing for the Cowboys.
It's all true.
We just loved Cliff Avril, and they managed to get him as a steal, right? Like, it's just unheard of to get a pass rusher as a steal.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't credit Pete and John that much with that offseason, as we should just fault every other NFL team for not signing Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril, because they signed them pretty late in free agency, both of them, right?
I don't know if it was necessarily late in free agency.
But, I mean, that was considering that they were... How much they... It was the offseason that they traded for Percy Harvin, right?
That checks out.
That in that offseason, they gave up so much to get something like Percy Harvin.
Avery was signed on March 13th, so that would be probably a week into free agency.
Okay, that was not late at all. It was just a good signing. But in that offseason, when they had to give up so much to get Percy Harvin, that they were... What was Cliff Avril paid right away?
2 year, $13 million.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm not disputing it.
I mean, he's like a 10-plus million pass rusher, easily, that they were able to get him. That, for that amount, is one of the best deals that those two have ever made.
Absolutely. Not as good as the Michael Bennett contract, by the way, which was 1 year, $4.8 million, only $1.5 million guaranteed, signed the next day, March 14th.
Wow!
That's partially because, of course, you'll recall that Bennett had a torn rotator cuff at that point that he played through during the 2013 season. So,
man. Well, I hope we're saying the same about Shamar Stephen this year.
Shamar Stephen and Tom Johnson are the new Cliff Avril and Michael Bennett. Oh, boy.
So
did you see that the Seahawks are only favored in three games?
Three games? Are you kidding
me? As pessimistic as I am about the Seahawks, they're about a 500 team.
Oh, yes.
So they should not be underdogs in 9 games.
It's almost like an extreme overcorrection to have them favored in 3 games.
Yes, to how much they... Like last year, Seahawks were getting too much respect for being the Seahawks, and now they've overcorrected the other way.
I thought that was crazy. What are the 3 games, by the way?
I do not know that off the top of my head.
Hosting Arizona has to be one.
Looks like it is September 23rd against Dallas, Seattle by 1.5.
Really?
December 2nd against San Francisco, Seattle by 1.
Really?
And December 23rd versus Kansas City, Seattle by 3. There's no line for the Arizona game because they don't put out lines for the final week until the week.
Because they're scared of Chosen Rosen.
But like the Seahawks are a pick'em at home against the Chargers.
But those 3 games, I would not really
put in that order. Yeah, I mean, that doesn't make a lot of sense. This home field advantage at Central League Field has been so substantial that I can't see that one.
Wow. Vegas is haters.
I mean, I guess, you know, the Seahawks can play the nobody believes in us card. That's always a good thing.
I like it. So anyway, on that note, are you ready to do 20 minutes on the This Is America video?
I've only watched it once, so I need to watch it like 10 more times before I'm ready to discuss it on a podcast. But we really should be taking advantage of the Donald Glover moment, because that's what this is right now.
I mean, we need to wait until Atlanta's over. We can wait until after this week to talk about, to put a bow on Atlanta, but...
Get caught up. If you're at home and you're not caught up, watch those shows. We're going to spoil the shit out of them.
That FUBU episode was devastating. It was amazing.
It was a lot.
I felt like, I don't know. This We talk about the greatest season of television ever a lot. Throw that term around.
Do we?
Oh, yeah. I've been saying it all the time. I personally feel
ever
like...
Ever said that?
I've lived all of, like, BoJack Horseman season 3 this week, but personally. But we just throw it around all the time. But I feel like this season of Atlanta is, like, every second is almost too much to comprehend.
The number of times during the season I've said, wow, this show is unlike anything else on TV. It's a lot.
It's, like, the most joyless show, too.
It's technically a comedy.
Yeah. It's going to win at the, at the Emmys next year. It's going to win Best Comedy Show.
It's going to be the one. It'll be going up against Barry.
It's like maybe 30 seconds of the entire show ever that has been funny, or at least season 2. The only funny part was Donald Glover talking about how it was U.S. legal tender.
Okay, on that note, get caught up for next week.
We're talking Atlanta next week, right?
Yeah.
All right.
And thanks for listening.
Thanks.